Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The New Hampshire House fails to pass the state budget, ceding influence over the state's next budget to the state Senate. The Senate, meanwhile, moves on a bill allowing towns to ratify election results affected by the blizzard. Governor Sununu's pick for Attorney General Gordon McDonald sails through the Executive Council, while D.C. Republicans nuke the Democratic filibuster backed by New Hampshire's U.S. Senator, paving the way for the installation of Judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. Good morning. All joined this week by Casey McDermott, NHPR trend spinner, New Hampshire Union leader Dan Barrick, also of NHPR. Good morning. Let's start by picking through the wreckage of the House's budget failure. The Finance Committee's spending plan totaled $11.9 billion. Like all budgets, it contained multitudes, more money to address a developmentally disabled wait list, reforms to the state's juvenile justice facility, dollars for local infrastructure. Those were just some of the policies included. Aid for full-day kindergarten wasn't. It had no new taxes and fees. I could obviously go on, but I guess I'll put this to you, Trent. This thing really didn't fail because of policy specifics as much as it did to the overall bottom line. Agreed?
Well, I guess it depends who you ask. It was quite a show these last few days in the State House. The House basically took a pass on the budget for the first time in decades. And so now it's up to the Senate to decide, working with the governor, on what happens with the state budget.
And so, you know, the culprits here, if you view them this way, would be the Freedom Caucus in the House. You know, the final budget vote, 32 Republicans opposed it. Dan, what did these folks want?
Well, in simple terms, the one thing they wanted was a smaller budget. They wanted less overall spending. Once you get beyond that, there wasn't a lot of specifics from this group of, you know, several dozen Republicans about particular policies that they found offensive or new items that they wanted in there. There was some concern, as articulated by Representative J.R. Hole, who sort of acted as a spokesperson for this group for much of the past week, about what he considered a sort of shell game with about $250 million, $250 million worth of federal funds that the House Finance Committee had decided to take off the books, arguing that it had, since that money had not yet been cleared by a special finance committee, joint fiscal committee, it shouldn't be counted towards the bottom line. That was sort of waived as sort of a bloody shirt in many of the hearings, as an example of the what Hole and other members of this caucus called the duplicity of this budget. But aside from that, I mean, the proposed solution, at least on the floor debates, was from this conservative group, was a simple, you know, 1.5% across the board cut, which, you know, in a pinch, those kinds of changes have happened to budgets. But there was no real clear disagreement, as I said, over specific line items or policy changes.
Well, why don't we take a listen to what one member of this Freedom Caucus, Representative Keith Ammon, had to say about the impasse on the budget.
Those of us in this caucus are tired of the games that politicians play in places like this, and we're not going to participate in it.
All right, that was Representative Keith Ammon, and I believe the games he was talking about was this issue about how to account for, you know, what they say is $200 million that was left out of the budget. You know, Casey, you've spent some time observing the House. You know, do you see this as a new, I mean, this is their basic job is to do things like pass a budget. Is this a real institutional failure?
I don't know if I have the institutional knowledge to say to make that kind of a declaration. It definitely, I think, speaks to You know, at least in my time here, I've only been here for a few years, but I think you see increasingly kind of deepening divisions within the parties at the House, particularly within the Republican Party at the House. And what we saw here was a fair amount of, as you said, an intra-party squabbling. This was less of an issue, as far as I can tell, of Democrats versus Republicans and more kind of Republicans versus Republicans and differences of opinion there. What's interesting to me is the extent to which there was you know, a lot of kind of coordination and planning going into the budget process this week on the part of the kind of so-called House Freedom Caucus. They met several times outside of the state house to kind of come to a consensus of, okay, this is what we want to see. We're going to go in on a united front. They met earlier this week at the offices of Americans for Prosperity in Manchester, just as kind of a like meeting place. There were, as I understand it, several other kind of conservative activists outside of the state house who were present at that meeting.
Including the former Speaker, Bill
Exactly.
O'Brien.
Yep. And that's also another interesting kind of element of all of this, is the extent to which people who are not necessarily involved in the legislature directly right now were trying to exert influence over the budget.
And I think that what Casey just outlined, and you made this point too on the air yesterday, Josh, is in some ways this was the battle lines were less the traditional partisan ones between Democrats and Republicans or liberals and conservatives, and really between institutionalists and, you know, sort of outsiders, the outside sort of lobbying that Casey described. And you even saw it on the House floor yesterday, where you had Democrats and Republicans, Representative Marjorie Smith, Neil Kirk, a Republican, Marjorie Smith, a Democrat, both making the same argument, which is the House as an institution, as a body, needs to take a step forward here.
Why don't we take a listen? We have tape of Marjorie Smith, I believe. Why don't we take a listen to what Marjorie Smith, former chair of the Finance Committee, Democrat from Durham, said on the House floor yesterday?
I see what has happened in other legislative bodies across the country and in Washington, and I never want to be part of that. I never want to be part of a body that says, let's tear the institution apart. Let the institution fail.
All right, that was Durham Democrat Marjorie Smith on the House floor yesterday, making the case that regardless of what one happened to think about a lot of the particulars in the budget proposal crafted by the Finance Committee, she was part of that committee, didn't initially support the budget. It's important for the House to take a position so that it can negotiate with the Senate. Tell us what you think. The number on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange at NHPR or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. You know, Marjorie Smith made that point, and as you mentioned, Dan, Representative Kirk, a Republican chair of the Finance Committee, he made the point that, you know, this may not be perfect, but it is better than the governor's plan. It is something that has the imprint of the hours of work that Finance Committee members, it has specifics, it has more.
And it gives the House a seat at the table, you know, which they really ceded now. They don't really have a very strong negotiating position as we enter the final stages of the budget negotiations in the later spring.
Well, I mean, why don't we take a listen to what House Speaker Sean Jasper said yesterday about the approach the House will be forced to take when it comes to getting its way on the budget, or trying to.
I think it's safe to say that you will see a lot of non-germane amendment hearings in the coming weeks, and you will be seeing many of these initiatives that failed here being resurrected as amendments to Senate bills. Unusual process, but we'll deal with it.
All right. That was House Speaker Sean Jasper talking about the approach that the House will be forced to take, tacking on non-germane policies onto bills, sending them over to the Senate. So at least there will have to be some sort of debate, and the House's position will be known. I mean, you know, the Senate tends to have a stronger hand in the budget anyway, given the calendar, given the when revenue numbers come in, given the smaller number of people in the Senate, and the budget expertise of Senate President Chuck Morse, at least for the preceding number of cycles. Does it make Governor Sununu's job easier as well, Trent? I mean, obviously, like, a lot of the policies he wanted in the budget, some of them weren't in the House's proposal. Full-day kindergarten, one of them. You know, he's already shown that he can work with the Senate. Does this make Governor Sununu's job easier?
I actually think this makes Governor Sununu's job significantly easier. And just look at the context. Speaker Jasper is trying to wrangle 400 members in the House 200 of them are more than 200 are Republicans, but he's got three dozen who really don't even agree with him being Speaker, let alone him leading budget discussions. So that is now out of the picture. And now you have Governor Sununu, who can work with Senate President Morse and Senator Jeb Bradley to really shape the budget in the Senate, where there are only 23 members right now. And so it'll be, I think, significantly easier for them to get some of their things, some of the things they want to get done, specifically full-day kindergarten. I think that you will see that there is support for that in the Senate, where there was not support in the House. So I think it actually is going to become a lot easier for Republicans. And it's just, it's interesting to see. I mean, 90 days ago, you know, we were looking at the first time Republicans held the governor's office, the House and the Senate, and everyone was talking about how much they're going to work together and get things done. And what we've seen is that that has not happened in the last 90 days. So this is going to be really their last big test to see if they can make it happen.
I mean, that is the sort of thing that we always say when one party takes control. But then if you actually look at cycles when one party does have control for the first time in a long time, you can look back to when Governor Benson was in, Republicans were really riding high. That ended up in a stalemate on the budget and a budget being vetoed and then a budget being passed. The veto was over too much spending. They actually spent a little bit more. When Democrats finally all took control, that was, some of the more challenging moments for Governor Lynch trying to sort of moderate the impulses of Democrats, particularly in the House. And, we have a somewhat similar dynamic in that, another advantage the Senate has is it doesn't have those intra-caucus fissures to the magnitude that they exist in the House.
I think there are a couple of fissures in the Republican Party, and I think that some of the senators you'll see in the on the Republican side, for example, Andy Sanborn from Bedford. I think that he probably agrees with some of what the House Freedom Caucus did. So I think that debate will still happen in the Senate. The other thing that's interesting to me is just to look at the perspective of the numbers we're talking about here. The governor's budget was $12.1 billion. The House budget was $11.9 billion. There's not a huge difference in the numbers, but the philosophies were just so different between where the governor is and where some of these members of the House Freedom Caucus were. I think the number one thing we'll be looking out for is how does that translate into the Senate? How many members of the Senate, especially on the Republican side, are going to have some of the same opinions as those members of the House who kind of clunked up the budget?
Well, I'm not sure how telling this is, but maybe it's worth mentioning that the votes in the House that were actually the closest were in support of what Democrats wanted on the budget on both the vote Wednesday on House Bill 1 and yesterday on House Bill 2. And, that is the coalition of kind of traditionalist Republicans with Democrats that got Speaker Jasper elected for the first time 4 years ago. It's been interesting to watch the cross-party collaboration kind of like wax and wane. And, Democrats felt pretty comfortable just kind of stepping back and for the most part, letting, the egg be on the Republicans' face out of yesterday. Speaker Jasper says he doesn't believe the divides that we saw on the budget exist on non-fiscal matters. And, there's a record so far this year, Dan, to suggest that he may be right.
Yeah, when you look at a lot of the business of the House, it's been business as usual. But I think in terms of the budget, the real to go back to your earlier question about what this might mean for Governor Sununu, I agree with Trent that this is not bad news for the governor per se. But, the person who's really strengthened by all this is Chuck Morse, as you said. Yesterday after the collapse of the House vote, he offered very, cordial and across the aisle statements about his willingness to consider the work of the House Finance Committee, even though it will no longer be on the table. But the truth of the matter is he's now the guy left holding the pencil for the last couple of months to actually write the budget. And what was interesting yesterday, I think, one of the things was just how unwilling anybody in a position of authority there seemed to be willing to kind of take leadership or take ownership of this. You had, the House Majority Office, Speaker Jasper and his team were not even willing to put an amendment on the table to attempt to build a coalition. They seemed, in fact, Majority Leader Dick Hinch said it would be I can't remember the exact word.
Would be disrespectful. That caught my eye. It's kind of weird.
He said it would be disrespectful for the Speaker's office to seek to amend the House Finance Committee's position. The governor was seen going in and out of caucus, but didn't exactly. He was not out there publicly trying to use the bully pulpit to rally Republicans to get something done. I think that dynamic simply solidifies what's been the case, as you said, Josh, for nearly a decade now, which is Chuck Morris and his leadership team in the Senate will really be able to put their thumbprint on the final budget.
Well, why don't we take a listen to what Senator Morris said yesterday, diplomatic, as you say, Dan, about how the Senate was going to be approaching this.
We respect the process that they just went through. We certainly understand that they brought up some stuff that we wanted to incorporate in the budget also, but everyone has to understand the Senate wants to go through its process now, and that's what we'll do.
All right, that was Senate President Chuck Morris. The Senate's going to be going through its process. Stay tuned to that, and let us know what you think about what happened with the House budget. Maybe you don't care. Maybe you think that the Freedom Caucus did something important. Maybe you're disappointed that the institution of government that's closest to the population, failed to do a basic task, which is pass a two-year spending proposal onto the state Senate. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. I just want to touch briefly on Governor Sununu's role in this. He did meet with the House Republican Caucus twice on Wednesday. I saw him running around the State House meeting with senators, and my understanding is that his meeting with the House, he pretty much said, I'm here to help if I can, but he chose not to try to tell them what to do. Does that strike you as wise, and that perhaps he's learned something based on his, 90-odd days in office?
I think it's difficult to have leverage over any House member. And I think that the governor learned that already on Right to Work. Learned it the hard way, maybe. Look, we just covered a special election in Manchester where one of the candidates won a House. It was a primary for a House seat for Andy Martell, who died. And one of the candidates won with 100 votes. And so how do you leverage? How do you bargain with someone who can get on the ballot with 100 votes and who could potentially win with a few hundred votes? It's really difficult. It's not like you can show up and spend $1 million on ads against them or something like that. So I think with the governor, I think that that many of the Republicans in the State House realize that the Senate is the place to do this, to make this deal happen. And so I think that's what we're going to have to see, if that's what actually works out.
I mean, it was interesting to watch during the debate. I was pondering, would there be any House members? Could there be any House members who could sort of reach across this deep divide to, the 35 or so Republicans who were just going to be, essentially hell no on this budget? And, I'm at the press riser. Directly in front of me is the kind of black ribboned chair at this point, a former Representative Steve Valancourt, who died. And, he was a moving floor speaker. And I was thinking, maybe a guy like that could have potentially swung a couple of people in that he could speak to the prerogatives of the House as the institution.
He shared many of those views
and was no, kind of easy mark for leadership in either party. But it is interesting to the degree to which, the House in its current incarnation does seem to have relatively few people who can really speak persuasively to, all precincts of the people's House, as it's known. Join us. Tell us what you think. 1-800-892-6477 or reach us on email at exchange@nhpr.org or on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange, joined this week by Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union leader Dan Barrick here at NHPR, as well as NHPR's digital reporter Casey McDermott. After a break, we'll get to some non-budgetary action at the legislature, but do tell us what you think about the budget. The first time in, the House clerk says that they have no record of this happening before, and certainly if it happened before, it predates even the most long-in-the-tooth House member, and there have been some people who have been there for, a quarter century. Stick around until after the break.
Ideas come naturally to writers.
Ah, I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Dan Barrick, news director here at NHPR, Trent Spinner, union leader, executive editor, and Casey McDermott, NHPR's digital reporter. While there was kind of dead in the water in the House, there was action this week in the legislature as policymakers continue to wrestle with the implications of the town elections postponed by last month's blizzard. 73 towns were called postpone elections. The Senate acted yesterday, passing a bill to let cities and towns ratify the results of postponed elections. Trent, what does this mean for cities and towns?
What it means is that cities and towns who potentially could have an issue with bonds. So here's what happened. Let me go back to the beginning. The Sunday before the election, we were looking at a really big storm on Tuesday. And so one of our reporters, Mike Cousineau, called up the Secretary of State, and he gave this quote that we ran as a banner headline saying, New Hampshire doesn't have snow days for elections. Well, it turns out 70-something cities and towns disagreed, and they decided to move their town meetings. And what a lot of the municipal attorneys are now saying is that if we don't pass legislation, we don't ratify some of these votes, the bonds, so all this money that we approved could be challenged. It would be very difficult for a town to go out to a bank and say, and I'm simplifying this, but for a town to go out to a bank and say, hey, we ratified $5 million. We voted to spend $5 million on a new police station. Please give us the $5 million, and then we'll pay you back over a certain number of years. The issue that these municipal attorneys are now saying is that these banks and the funders, the investors, potentially would take issue with the procedure before the vote. So they're looking for the legislature to ratify these town meeting results, or at least give them a tool to somehow ratify them on the town level so that they can go out and actually bond the money that they voted to approve.
Now, the bill that was before the Senate, that passed pretty easily, 21-2. Interestingly, there was language in it that really went after the Municipal Association, which had suggested that citing RSA 40:4 suggested that moderators had the authority to move voting day of a meeting in the event of a weather emergency. Obviously, Secretary of State Gardner has a different interpretation of that. You know, what do you make of that, the language that was in there, essentially saying this is the Municipal Association put these elections at risk?
I think that this is very rare to see for the State House, for the legislature to specifically target a group in legislation and say, hey, you gave your cities and towns really bad advice.
Well, particularly when their job is to give legal advice in
yes.
these scenarios.
Yes.
I mean, they're municipal lawyers. They were interpreting the law as they saw it. And in this case, I think it is interesting and noteworthy that, you know, again, I haven't been around long here, but it's odd to me to see that kind of language included in legislation as opposed to, you know, perhaps a statement or a comment that is given by legislators or officials outside of actually what would potentially end up on the books.
Let's not forget, there was a crisis the day before the election. The governor called in the Secretary of State, called in the Attorney General and said, what, fellas, what can we do here? What, you know, we've seen that some towns are already rescheduling their town meetings. Is there something we can do as a state? And they decided it. They said, the governor said, hey, look, we don't think you should move your meetings, but we're not going to do anything about it if you do. And so they were upset that towns were doing this. And they've still been, they've remained upset throughout the last few weeks.
Well, in the bill in the Senate wasn't the only action on this front. There was an attempt, it's kind of a rough week for Speaker Jasper, clearly, to get some language attached as a non-germane amendment in a separate bill in a House committee that would have given towns the options to hold another ratification vote. And, you know, it had that vote failed, then, you know, the earlier elections that took place due to the schedule change would have been undone, potentially unseating officials. And, yeah. and that vote deadlocked in committee, and because it was a non-germane amendment, it failed on an even vote. You know, what do you make of that, Dan?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if you just look at the policy of how much that would have added clarity to this already confusing situation. It would have allowed towns to hold a vote in May to, as you say, ratify the earlier votes in March. So there's all sorts of questions about just that time gap for many of the reasons Trent laid out about the need to start, you know, to start moving ahead with bonds that have been voted on. And it also adds just another electoral hurdle that raises all sorts of questions. What if that fails? So, but I do think, you know, recalling that day, which was, you know, just only a month ago, there, as both Casey and Trent said, there was a lot of confusion that day. Towns had already started in the days before Election Day, in the absence of any clear, you know, public statement from the state to delay elections. There was somewhat of a mixed message coming from the governor's office saying, we don't think you should, but if you, but we're not banning it. And you had the Municipal Association offering its own legal advice. So there was not – it's not – so I don't think it's fair to, you know, call the towns that delayed, you know, they were not acting – there was no active defiance. It was really just they were trying to make the best decision in a confusing circumstance.
In this language that Speaker Jasper wanted under discussion, it ought to be noted, was also supported by Secretary of State Bill Gardner, who, you know, as we've said, was quite adamant that in his view there is no flexibility when it comes to postponing elections. Why don't we go to the phones? Mark is on the line from Manchester. Good morning, Mark. Go ahead.
Good morning, Josh. I think these guys from the Freedom Caucus are real heroes. And they stood up to a lot of pressure from leadership and certainly from the majority on their own side of the aisle to go along and go with the budget. So I think the government, the state government, spends too darn much. And frankly, I'm happy to see them push back. I'd like to see them lower spending a bit.
So I recognize your voice. I believe this is former State Rep Mark Warden, correct?
That's right.
Okay. So, Mark, I mean, as somebody who's been in the legislature, obviously the House cedes its position. You've been around long enough to know how the Senate tends to handle budgets. Do you believe that the Senate is going to come up with a budget that Freedom Caucus members are going to be inclined to like more than the one that the House Finance Committee crafted?
Ultimately, I think they will like it a bit better than what came out of House Finance. Historically, in my experience, the House is a bit more conservative, but it seems like the last term, the coin's been flipped and the Senate has been pretty strong on keeping a line on the budget and certainly be more realistic on its expected revenue. So I'm interested to see what's coming out of it, but I don't think it'll be any worse than what the House Finance Committee was going to
forward. All right. Thanks for the call, Mark. That is one interesting element of this, the degree to which the Freedom Caucus is essentially putting its faith in the state Senate. The state Senate does tend to, you know, have a stronger hand when it comes to the budget in terms of achieving an outcome. But that was a question I put to Representative Holey yesterday. And he, you know, the Freedom Caucus believes that the budget needs to stay within the rate of inflation. He said he's confident that the Senate can come up with what he referred to as a 3% solution. You know, we'll see later this spring.
But that point by former Representative Warden, that the Senate will come up with a more conservative budget proposal. That may well have been the bet that several of these Freedom Caucus members were making. I don't think any of them really anticipated the outcome that we saw. I don't think any of them were actually pushing for a failure to pass the budget. They were hoping to get a lower budget come out of the House, but not one in which the House essentially has no bargaining position going into it. So that's, you know, and that's where we are.
Well, in watching Representative Hull when he and Representative Ammon were by the press riser, and when it was clear that this was going nowhere, Representative Hull turned to Representative Ammon and said, you know, we won. And, you know, I think that they would have considered a better victory, as you say, to get some sort of back of the budget reduction. But, you know, throwing your boot in the cogs and making the machine stop, you know,
it's a strategy.
Tell us what you think. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange at NHPR or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Let's turn to another election-related issue, and that is the long-running saga on New Hampshire's battle over ballot selfies. The Supreme Court weighed in this week, Casey, by not weighing in. Tell us what happened.
So this all started going back to, I believe, a law that was passed in 2014, which made displaying a picture of a marked ballot a crime, basically. You had some people who defied that, among them a state lawmaker. And the courts have weighed in several times. This has gone now all the way up to
It's been
the,
a pretty consistent message.
Yeah, it's been
from
a pretty consistent message
it
that the courts see it as a freedom of speech issue. They say that the New Hampshire law that was passed banning this is unconstitutional, infringes on people's right to free expression. The Secretary of State's office in particular takes a much different view of this. If you ask Secretary of State Bill Gardner, he will say that the ballot box is a sacred place, that there should never be anything that infringes upon someone's, you know, activities in there, and that he sees it, ballot selfies, as they're kind of called shorthand, open the door to voter coercion. So basically, his argument is that, you know, if I have a boss who says, I want you to vote this way, and
Dan
I want you
could
to
say,
give
prove it
exactly,
to me, Casey.
Yeah,
how did you
prove
vote?
It. Bring your ballot into work. Bring me a picture of your ballot, or you can't bring your ballot into work, but bring me a picture of the way that you voted to show me, so that I know that you voted this way. The courts have said, basically, the most recent court that has weighed in on this said that by banning ballot selfies altogether, the state is casting too wide a net, that they're not effectively targeting their law to only address the problem that they're looking at, and in the process infringing upon a lot of people's right to free speech. So
But as far as the Secretary of State goes, this fight
is
going to continue.
Well, it's not over. Yeah. I talked to him earlier this week, and basically what the Supreme Court did this week, the new part of this, is that you know, as we said, the Secretary of State is very adamant about their position. They fought this all the way to, or tried to fight this all the way to the nation's highest court. The Supreme Court has a lot of discretion in the cases that it takes up and decided that it didn't want to take up this case at this time. When I talked to the Secretary of State earlier this week about all of this and asked him basically, so in your view, you know, is this fight over? He said no. So he said there are other avenues that we can go down to, you know, limit photography in the polling places. He likened it to a courtroom. He said that, you know, I'm paraphrasing him, but basically was making the argument that in some courtrooms you can't take pictures because it's a sacred place.
I mean,
place.
Making every voter turn in their cell phone the way they do if you visit the federal
court
might be cumbersome.
So I don't know how logistically that's going to work out. And it also raises another question about what that might mean. And again, they didn't float any specific policies at this point, but what kind of additional responsibilities that would place on poll workers who, you know, as we've seen with the number of other voting legislation reforms that have been put forward, they're already being asked to do a lot on election day. So I don't know how receptive people would be to this idea that they're now going to be kind of phone police at the polls. But it will be interesting to see just, you know, how the state decides to proceed even after multiple courts have said that what you're trying to do is not constitutional.
I mean, this whole controversy and the Secretary of State's continued interest in this topic did make me ponder the question of what would be the very absolute worst ballot selfie, in his estimation, one taken at a rescheduled election, potentially. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477, email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this morning by Casey McDermott, NHPR Transmitter, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dan Barrick, also of NHPR. Let's step out of the statehouse for a minute. Obviously, later this morning, the U.S. Senate is going to be voting on Neil Gorsuch's seeming confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. That comes after Republicans broke Democrats' filibuster by going nuclear, as they say, changing the rules to allow a simple majority. New Hampshire Senators Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan do plan to vote against Gorsuch. Why don't we take a listen to what Senator Shaheen told Morning Edition about Judge Gorsuch earlier this week?
This is about the views of Judge Gorsuch, and he is too extreme for most of the Democrats, and that's why we've said we think President Trump should come up with another selection.
All right. That was U.S. Senator Gene Shaheen speaking with NHPR earlier this week. You know, Shaheen says that she believes that Neil Gorsuch is too extreme. you know, this whole debate, and, you know, people can have different opinions about how much Republicans' actions on Merrick Garland refusing to hold hearings or consider voting on him in the last year of President Obama's administration is coloring this whole thing. But it does seem that, you know, the idea of a straight up judging of a judge's qualifications as a jurist, you know, kind of seems quaint in this day and age, Dan.
Well, it does. I mean, and you could even, you know, Democrats would even push the argument back further to the final to the Obama administration when Republicans refused to take votes on several of his federal court appointees. What's interesting is it's this weaving together. What, you know, Senator Shaheen in that interview repeatedly, you know, bolstered her justified her decision to support a filibuster of Neil Gorsuch based on his ideology and his judicial record. There's an interweaving there of the Merrick Garland instance as, you know, not describing it as a tit for tat. In fact, Senator Shaheen went out of her way to sort of say this is not a political tit for tat. But that instance clearly still shadows this entire proceeding around Justice Gorsuch.
And I guess it'll be interesting to see where this goes from here. Whether we're for the foreseeable future going to be in a position where simple majorities are going to be justices get confirmed, and given the age of several on the U.S. Supreme Court, this may not be President Trump's final pick.
Why would Democrats go back now, even if they retook the Senate? Why would they put the 60 vote majority threshold back in?
Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Casey McDermott, NHPR, Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dan Barrick, also of NHPR. You know, former U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte was obviously involved in introducing Neil Gorsuch around Capitol Hill. And, you know, the thought was that she was going to potentially help Gorsuch attracts some support across the aisle. She had a reasonable relationship with Democrats. See what the final tally is. I mean, and whether the numbers have changed since things have gone nuclear, as they say. I mean, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Heidi Heitkamp, another senator, both of whom were up for reelection, had said that they were open to supporting Gorsuch. We'll wait on the tally. But one thing that also happened to Kelly out this week was the announcement that she had won election to the board of the Rupert Murdoch-controlled News Corp, which is the parent company of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post. Does this make you – what do you read into this trend? I mean, does this suggest that Kelly Ayotte, may not be eyeing a return to public office? Is this role something that one could do in return? Neither. Certainly a good way to make money. She's going to get paid $250,000.
That's what I read into this, that she is going to get paid $250,000 a year, $100,000 in cash, and another $150,000 in deferred News Corp stock. On average, there's about one meeting a month, which I think is a great job if you can get it. I've heard some whispers that she may potentially lead some sort of, she's a former attorney general here in New Hampshire. She could potentially lead some sort of board level investigation into some of the sexual assault claims that are happening at Fox. So that would keep her profile pretty high up in the news. So I don't know if this means she's not going to run again. I think that this is a kind of job, being a relatively conservative Republican senator, this is a kind of a job that you could do and it wouldn't hurt your chances one way or the other.
Seems like just kind of a safe holding place until, the time comes to maybe more seriously consider the next step. As Trent said, she could potentially be involved in efforts on the board or just kind of lie low. But either way, she's not necessarily, I think she could probably make of it what she wants to in terms of the public profile that she maintains there.
And she does replace Elaine Chao, who left this post when she was selected by President Trump to be Transportation Secretary. Stick around until after the break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange.
I
Ideas come naturally to writers.
I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Joined this week by Dan Barrick, NHPR, Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union leader, and Casey McDermott, also of NHPR. Why don't we go to the phones? Victoria is on the line from Northwood. Good morning, Victoria. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to note that the Freedom Caucus, the people that got this thing going, they're members of the Free State Project, Keith Ammon and J.R. Hole. And this is part of Free State Project's statement of intent, long-term goals. Their planning is to basically try to deconstruct state government, cut budgets, and this is why they shamelessly tried to do this week, and their plans are to do more of this in the future. So I just think it's really important that people are paying attention to that.
All right, thanks for the call. It is true that several members of the Free State Project are members of the New Hampshire House and were active in fighting this budget. Thanks for the call.
I mean, that's sort of a fluid association, too, but I think at the very least you could say there's a sympathetic ideology across the two groups, this so-called Freedom Caucus and the Free State Project.
Yeah, and I do think fluid association is a good way to put it, because sometimes, one thing about people in organizations like a Freedom Caucus or the Free State Project is that, don't misunderstand them too quickly. They obviously come with an ideological point of view, but there are people who are in and out, although both J.R. Hole and Keith Ammon, have been affiliated. Barbara's on the line from Henniker. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi. How is everybody this week?
We're well.
I just wanted to add a little bit to the conversation on the budget process. Obviously, I experienced it for 24 years, and I know the ups and downs. But the situation we have now, I believe, is far more serious. It reaches out. It's not just in the legislature that the problem exists. It's when we look at who we're electing. Like it or not, the Freedom Caucus is the Americans for Prosperity. They don't care about government. They're there to destroy government. They really don't care about the common good. It makes me feel bad. I wish they weren't like that. But that's what we're dealing with. And it's all over the country. We're not the only ones. But it's a very difficult thing to deal with.
Well, as someone, Rob, let me cut you off. This is, former Representative Barbara French. As someone who was in the House for a good number of years, do you think that one thing that struck me about the way that Republican leadership, Speaker Jasper, other top people with him, is that, there was ample warning that this was coming, but at some level, it just didn't really seem to fully compute that the Freedom Caucus was really going to say no. Do you think that that's just a sign of the way in which the House as an institution, there's certainly segments of it that aren't really interested in protecting an institutional position the way that somebody like Speaker Jasper, the way that, you I don't know if you were listening to the debate or earlier on, the way Representative Smith.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's terribly important, but I don't think they care, unfortunately. I'm sorry. So I think we have to look at and get to know who we're electing.
All right. Loud and clear. Thanks for calling, Representative French. Get to know who we're electing. I mean, that's supposed to be the essence of the House, given that it's, one rep per 3,800 people. But it is also true that you talk to your average person on the street and you say, who's your House member? Oftentimes you get a blank stare. Tell us what you think. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We have an email also from a former lawmaker. Susan of Tamworth says, doesn't the budget have to originate in the House? How can the Senate pass a budget without HB1 coming to it from their House? Would there be a rules suspension is that constitutional? Dan?
It's a good question, and I think one that was a novel one for many lawmakers. But shortly after the House vote yesterday, the Senate Majority Office announced that they would be essentially attaching as amendments the two main budget bills, HB 1 and HB 2, as introduced by Governor Sununu, to two other House bills. So the first order of business that the Senate Finance Committee, when it meets on Monday, will have to essentially just glom on the existing budget bills onto two other House bills. So the letter, the letter of that law will be maintained, that it will be House bills already passed by the House that will be kind of carrying the budget through the Senate.
All right, thank you, Susan, for the email. It's it's going to be interesting to watch both that aspect and to the extent to which Speaker Jasper makes good on his claim that the House is going to be attaching lots of component parts of its budget to various bills and see what the Senate chooses to do to that. Call us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org. Why don't we go to the phones? Dave is on the line from Keene. Good morning, Dave.
Hi. I was going to say one quick thing first. I'm pretty sure J.R. Hoyle isn't a Free State Project member. I think he's a New Hampshire native. But I was going to say one thing. What about this scenario? Gorsuch doesn't like the idea that rules are being changed because of him, and he steps away from the nomination.
That's a theory I have not heard yet. Dave, the vote's supposed to be at 11:30, my understanding, the Senate vote. We'll see what happens with Neil Gorsuch, but thank you for the call. Why don't we step out of the political realm, or somewhat step out of the political realm, and I want to turn to a legal case your paper's been covering, Trent, for a long time now, and a defamation case involving the electronic billboard on South Willow Street that many of our listeners have probably seen. It's colorful, goes after a host of prominent New Hampshire business and political figures owned by Michael Gill. What happened in that case this week?
Michael Gill, who owns Mortgage Specialist, has this sign on South Willow Street and in a couple of other locations around the state that makes accusations against a number of prominent business owners in the city. This week, what happened was Judge Will Delker decided that Michael Gill does not have any evidence that Alex Walker tried to commit attempted murder. Gill said, hey, I have all these witnesses, I think it was 80-something witnesses who will testify that this happened, but they're all anonymous, and I can't give you any information about them. And so the judge finally said, hey, you are committing defamation here. You have no evidence that Alex Walker committed any crime. Alex Walker, he's the attorney for Catholic Medical Center. You have no evidence that he's done anything wrong, and so you are committing defamation.
And it's not simply Attorney Walker who Gill's gone after, Dick Anagnost.
I believe the mayor, too.
Yeah,
he's gone. Gene Shaheen was just added to the list. I was driving by the other day. Andy Cruz from Auto Fair, which if you stand on South Willow Street and you look at the sign, you can see the Auto Fair sign on the other side of the highway.
I believe the sign accuses him of being a drug dealer.
Of being a drug dealer, right, along with a prominent city developer. And so the judge and the issue has been that almost every judge.
Well, this is the third judge.
This is the fourth judge.
Oh, the fourth
now.
Judge. Okay.
Yes, because every judge has either worked on a case or something else. And so Michael Gill has successfully been able to argue that all these judges have a conflict of interest, including some very well-respected judges in the state who, we would know. And anyway, finally, Judge Delker decided he did not have a conflict. He could take the case. Now, here's the thing. Alex Walker won his case, but Andy Cruz, Dick Anagnost, all those and a few other people had a separate case. So their case is still pending. Alex Walker just won his.
But so – and the resolution, I mean, Judge Delker ordered you guys sort this out or I will in terms of determining a judgment?
Right. Exactly. And there could potentially be a jury trial still to decide how much money – Alex Walker could recoup from Michael Gill, but the judge said, hey, you guys figure out the monetary issue here and come back to me for a settlement.
All right. Why don't we return to the phones? Dave's on the line from Rochester. Good morning. Go right ahead, Dave. Okay. Dave is not on the phone in Rochester. So, another story that your paper has been writing about, Trent, that I'm curious about is the controversy over New Hampshire's human trafficking task force. There have been several issues there. This is a federally funded initiative. Controversy over the person appointed to be its director because of her past advocacy for legalization of prostitution. Police department doesn't like this. Where is this heading?
This is an interesting story. The federal government gave the Manchester Police Department and a number of other nonprofits, a number of nonprofits in the state, almost $750,000 to fight human trafficking in New Hampshire. It was a big deal when it happened. Senator Shaheen held a press conference, talking about how great this grant would be. Anyway, so this nonprofit organization was chosen to actually administer the grant. And so this group hired a woman named Kate D'Amato, who in previous jobs had advocated for the legalization of prostitution. And it's still her personal opinion that prostitution should be legal. And the argument is basically so that people who work as prostitutes are no longer, they can have some sort of level of safety.
Harm reduction.
Yes. The Manchester Police Department does not agree with that. The U.S. Attorney's Office does not agree with that. And they're all part of this task force. So before this, before Kate D'Amato even got here, we did some reporting about where she stood on the issue. And she said, hey, I'm coming up here, but that's my personal opinion. But I understand that is not what the grant is for. The grant is to stop human trafficking. And I also understand that a lot of the partners who are involved in this do not agree with it. We did a right to know request to actually get the grant, and it says specifically in it, you cannot promote the legalization of prostitution. The issue comes, she was at a coffee shop talk, and we don't have the video of what she said, but a number of state reps who were there said that she was talking about the legalization, promoting the legalization of prostitution. After that, the Manchester Police Department said, hey, you either fire her or we're out of this grant.
What are the implications of them saying we're out of this grant? What would that mean?
Well, they have the money. So it's unclear it's not like they can't give the money back. They also don't have the authority to fire her because they're not technically administering the grant. They were just kind of a partner on this big federal grant. So the implications are not clear. And we have been asking other people, including Senator Shaheen's office, what they think. And, it's unclear whether there will be enough political pressure for the nonprofit administering this, for them to say, hey, maybe we should find someone else to do it, or if they will stick with Kate D'Amato.
Okay, so lots to watch on that story. As we wind up, I just want to talk a little bit about it. It just seems like Election Day was yesterday, and I'm not talking about the winter storm election, but last November. But, there is stirring out there looking towards 2018, and it's the first congressional district, which really will be a focus for Republicans. It's certainly a seat that history has proven is definitely one that can flip and flop, and Republicans see that as winnable. We have Eddie Edwards, a former chief of liquor enforcement for the Liquor Commission, getting into the race. What does this tell you, Dan, that there's action? And we also have Steve Marchand, who ran for governor as a Democrat unsuccessfully, finished second in the Democratic primary, throwing his hat in the ring. What does it say to you that these races are starting so early?
Well, you said the first congressional district with Eddie Edwards. I mean, I think that's sort of its own animal. That's been a place for the last few cycles. Obviously, it's been one that's flipped and flopped between Democrat Carol Shea Porter, who now holds it, and Republican Frank Ginta. The two of them have gone, I believe, four times head to head. So there's just that's a pretty—
It just seems like more luck.
That one rests on a razor's edge. But even within those Republican primaries each year, it's attracted a lot of Republican political talent. So, it's an effort, I would think, by Edwards to just sort of at least make it clear he's going to be in the game. That will attract a big Republican primary if history is any indication. On the governor's race, I don't know. I mean, I think Marchand's announcement caught a lot of people by surprise. He ran a good campaign just last year.
Well, and kind of a sleeper campaign in some ways. I mean, he came in second after, maintaining a pretty low, I don't want to say a low profile, but I don't think that anyone would have pegged him for a second place finisher early on in the campaign.
I'm not sure you could call it a campaign exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, he acquitted himself well. He's a good speaker. He acquitted himself well in the debates.
Exactly.
But in terms of the actual nuts and bolts of you know, having local.
There was much less kind of like grassroots operation or, you know, kind of infrastructure, certainly than the Van Ostern and Connolly campaigns who were his opponents in that race. But yeah, I mean, I think it's I mean, it just seems like we kind of can't get away from like campaigning. And I'm kind of, you know, exhausted thinking about all of the kind of back and forth that we might be in store for here now more than a year out.
Well, and to the extent that my understanding, I wasn't on the conference call where he made this announcement, but my understanding, there was a heavy stress on, Chris Sununu and Donald Trump, and Donald Trump and Chris Sununu, and Donald Trump and Donald Trump. And obviously, that's a time-tested technique for the out party to link, you know, whomever to the president.
And you've already seen Democrats in New Hampshire have been trying to not only tie Governor Sununu to the Republican churn within the legislature, which, you know, may or may not be a fair point, but it's an argument they're making, but also to tie this Freedom Caucus to the Congressional Freedom Caucus's actions just a week or two ago on the ACA repeal. So that's going to be a tight, you know, that's going to be a tight bind. It's sort of a bind that Democrats are definitely going to try and wrap around the governor going into 18.
And certainly more a closer election where we're getting a little bit of clarity this week is the state Senate special election, which will fill the vacancy left by the death of Scott McGilvery. David Booten, who stepped down from that seat, decided not to seek re-election, saying he essentially wanted to go out on at the top of his game, seems to believe that, you know, he's still at the top of his game, or, you know, his best game may not be necessary, but it'd be good to win a seat. He's getting in that race, as is a name familiar in New Hampshire politics, although not terribly recently, which is, Jim Norman, who ran for governor and was an executive counselor. Trent, I'm assuming your paper's obviously going to be covering that
one
closely.
We're going to be covering that. One thing to keep in mind is that former Senator Booten still has $40,000 in his campaign fund, which is no small amount of money for a Senate seat. Just want to go back one point. Two really interesting things between Eddie Edwards and Steve Marchand. On Eddie Edwards, don't forget he was a very close supporter of Frank Ginta, and actually worked in Ginta's office. So I think Eddie Edwards running could potentially mean that Frank Ginta's not. I'm surprised that Ginta hasn't been named to some sort of Washington, D.C. post yet. I think he's been trying to get
he's
a job there.
Surprised too.
Yeah, and then on Steve Marchand, it was interesting to see within moments of the announcement, Colin Pio, who was the campaign manager for one of Marchand's opponents, almost immediately said, thanks, but no thanks. So I think we'll see more people get into that Democratic primary.
Okay, we can't get away from politics. Thank you this week. This is the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. Thank you to Trent Spinner, Casey McDermott, and Dan Barrick. Have a good weekend, all.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.